Before we get to the questions, fun and games, I thought I might spend the next few minutes just to talk about the five obstacles to meditation and also the antidote to that. That way people can use these as a tool to deal with certain things that appear in your meditation. Obviously, we had a few days already to kind of focus on stilling the mind and to try the different kind of approaches to watching the mind. And if you haven't had jhanas yet, it's more likely that one of these five are responsible for your disturbance. And like I said, we're trying to look at not me, not mine, not a self. It's not your meditation, it's a meditation. And we try to apply. If it's not working, then it's because one of these obstacles are in your way. And today I will try to describe the obstacles as well as the antidote to these obstacles, and then allow you the tools to apply into your meditation and to see and hopefully to achieve much happiness and stillness. Okay? I'll name the five first, and then we'll go through each of them. They are kamachanda, which means sensual desires, vayapada, which means ill will. The other one is sloth and torpor. Then you have restlessness and remorse, and you have doubt. Okay, those are the five suspects. So any time that the meditation is not working, usually one of these five. Buddha described five obstacles, not six, not four, not two, five. Okay, so remember that. And also, unless you're enlightened, these are also in the mind most of the time, all the time. Okay, these are the five. And the first two are the most important one to pay attention to. And that's what we, and I think that's the reason why the Buddha named them, the first two. And usually it's in order. First one is like a sensual desires, liking, and the second one is ill will, right? Sensual desires when, we are interested in the five sense world, wanting comfort. Right? You're sitting here and you're thinking, wow, that lunch, this afternoon was really good. I wish I was back there again. Or whatever, at home. Oh, I wish I was at home, my comfortable chair. I wish I wasn't sitting on the floor. So anything like that that pulls you away from the present moment because you're not getting enough happiness here. So any interest in the five sense world is the sensual desires. The second one, and this means liking, right? We like something, we want, comfortable, we want soft touches, we want some warmth all the time, and which is, it's okay, it's nothing, it's not anything wrong in itself, but it just pulls you away from the present moment, this wanting comfort, wanting pleasant things. Okay, so that's number one, and that's most people are concerned with that. The second one is vayapada, is ill will. We hear a noise, we're thinking, I thought I told him that, I told them everybody to be mindful yesterday. Why aren't they being mindful? Why they're slamming doors? And so that pushes away from the present moment again, right? Or we're sitting here and the knee's hurting, so we get a bit irritated, get angry. We think, I'm hopeless. I can't meditate. If I was 20 years younger, then I know I could get into jhana right away. But now that I'm old, it's too late. I just have to make good karma. Next time I could be born with a good body. So there's any irritations, any anger that appears in the mind pushes us away from the present moment again. Okay, and these are the main two suspects to look out for when the mind isn't peaceful. Liking, disliking, wanting, not wanting. They're the main thing. The third one is my favorite, sloth and torpor. Because it's actually not a problem. Sloth and torpor just means that, one, we're very tired, you had a busy week, you can't sleep at night for some reason if it's a new place, or just working hard. So when you sit still, and also if you're an active person, every time you're moving, doing things, managing, and when you sit still, the mind just turns off. Oh, it must be sleepy time, so it turns off. Because that's what I remember when I was a lay person going my first meditation retreat, because I work in the banking industry, very busy, lots of doing, thinking, planning, talking to people. And I remember spending a good 5 or 6 days of my retreat just nodding away, because I'm just not used to cultivating the stillness. Stillness, but also bright, aware, awake, and alert. The only time I kind of stood still, the only time my body was still, was bedtime. And so every time I sat, it was just like... So it's not a major problem, except if we fight it too much. Sometimes we're sitting here, and we feel a little bit sleepy. But then something says, oh no, I shouldn't be sleepy. I'm a good meditator. I'm experienced. I've been doing this for 10 years. I've got to strive, put effort in, you know, straighten my back. Take a deep breath and just take charge. That may work from time to time. But a lot of time, you know, you might start to swing from, because the sense of self springs up and we're trying to put a lot of energy behind it. Actually, the mind might swing from sloth and torpor to the other side, restlessness. The mind starts to think. You might be awake, but it's not peaceful because you're thinking away, you're moving. And so that happens a lot as well. I remember my first few years to train the monastery, because everybody says, you know, sloth and torpor is bad. You're wasting time sitting there, and it's no good if you're peaceful but not aware. So you strive, you know, put forth effort to focus on the breath or do walking meditation. And because in Thailand, once a week, we have to stay up all night. So everybody's sitting up there, your friends are sitting in the asana. So you don't want to be the one that's nodding, right? So you want to be look good, straighten up. Put a lot of effort into being awake. But yeah, the willpower is it works, but it doesn't last very long. And it's very stressful because you have to expend a lot of energy to hold your body and to kind of force the mind. So then you might be astray, you might be awake for a little bit, but then because you're working so hard, it goes back to dullness anyway. So you swing from dullness to really hyperactivity and go back to dullness, and missing the between bits, which is stillness, but also awake, aware, and alert. So I found over the years, just making peace with that. Just, yeah, okay, I'm nodding. It's okay. Just try to maintain as much awareness as you can. And then allow just to know, okay, yeah, I'm nodding. Okay, it's no big deal. It's not the end of the world. And after a while, when the mind does rest, it brightens up naturally by itself. Right? And you can tell whether you're tired or whether sometimes the mind does go into this dark spot, sloth and torpor. Well, because you're bored as well, right? You're sitting here, you know, watching the breath, day in, day out, nothing's happening. Your body starts to ache. So I don't want to do this. So the mind turns off. So that's what you have to watch for. So some of that sloth and torpor is, underneath that is a bit of ill will. So you watch whether it's tired, and you usually if you're just tired, the mind brightens up after about, you know, a few minutes, maybe half an hour, naturally. But if you have ill will, then you know, no matter how long you sit there, the mind will turn off because it's not interested. So it's good to then just to get up and do some walking meditation, do something to ease the mind, make it more comfortable, make it more enjoyable somehow. Okay? And that's sloth and torpor. But also the nice thing about sloth and torpor is that at least it's peaceful, at least it's not too much suffering. You may be fading out. But if you learn, you have enough mindfulness to see the mind when it starts to drop into this kind of dark space. So you kind of nudge it a little bit towards awareness. Then it may actually go into the space where it's still, but also bright. Where it's awake, aware, and alert. But yeah, so just to work with the mind and just, you know, just nudge the mindfulness lightly. So over time you find that, the mind does... awaken, becomes bright after a while. So that's the antidote to sloth and torpor. Either go to sleep or just make peace with it. Okay? Yes, I forgot. The antidote to sensual desire of wanting things is contentment. You know, just say, whatever is happening is good enough. Right? Whatever you're sitting here, it's too hot, too cold, oh, this is good enough. I'm happy to be here. And also, the only true antidote to sensual desire is happiness. So that's why I always encourage people to, you know, be flexible, be nice and gentle to your body and to your mind. That way you have a certain happiness. When you're happy, comfortable, then the mind will stay in the present moment without having to force it, right? When you engage the mind with the breath, you know, make things interesting somehow, then the mind stays in the present moment because it's, you know, it's got a certain level of happiness already. You can do different kind of reflections to brighten the mind. Reflections on, you know, the Buddha, the fact that you're coming into contact with an enlightened being, and the fact that he, you know, he teaches this amazing Dhamma for the realization, for the, you know, from the freedom from suffering. So, or reflecting on any of the inspiring teachers that you met, any of that kind of brings happiness to the mind. Reflecting on your own generosity, the fact that you've, you know, any time that you've done anything selfless, help other people, any time you help out the monasteries, go to the hospital, donate blood. Any of these kind of reflection brings a certain brightness and a certain happiness in the mind that helps it stay in the present moment. Okay? And ill will was the antidote to that is obviously loving kindness. I was, and it's something that to, we all have to develop. If you practice when you're in kind of, you know, in daily life, it helps you to obviously get along with the people that you live with or work with. But its benefits is deeper than that. It's also in meditation. If you are a gentle and kind person, then it's the same. You, whatever you see, you're just going to make peace with it. You accept it unconditionally without fighting with it, right? So that's why anything irritating comes up, a noise, pain in your body, you can just to hold it, to make peace with it, allow it to be, allow it to fade away. But we don't, we cultivate a fault-finding mind, and we're sitting here and everything's wrong, right? You meditate, you know, the breath is boring, it's not doing anything, your body is hurting so much, people next door is annoying you, people, you know, teacher, terrible, and went to Ajahn Brown. Why didn't I have the good karma to go to Ajahn Brown's retreat? Why am I get this one? So anything, everything can be wrong. But you make peace, you say, okay, this is good enough, I have this great karma, just to be in this quiet place, this is good enough. But I'm not asking for much. I'm not asking for jhanas, I'm not asking for the bright nimittas. I'm just happy to be here. Happy, grateful for not having to cook, happy to have people, you know, cook for me. Happy to have the food that we get. So this sense of acceptance, sense of gratitude, also brings brightness to the mind. And having loving kindness, you know, it's easy to live with people. You don't have to, you know, go to a quiet place all the time, have to run into the forest to stay away from the people in the sala. We're quite happy to sit and just bring up, you know, everybody's here. It's really pure-hearted. They'll have the good intention to come, to cultivate peace and kindness, and, you know, and also to cultivate harmlessness, just for them, not just for themselves, but also for, you know, the all beings. So we bring up, you know, the goodness in other people, the positive qualities of being together. It also helps the mind to go into this kind of space where it's, you know, it's bright, it's at peace, accepts everything unconditionally without making, you know, choosing, dividing. Okay, so that's the antidote to ill will, is loving kindness, friendliness, acceptance, whatever works for you. Okay, in terms of different words. Antidote to, I was saying, to sloth and torpor, sleepiness, is go to sleep or make peace. Just to say, okay, yeah, it's not the end of the world. restlessness and remorse. This is has to do more with, it's just not usually the thinking mind, but it has to do more with the our moral conduct. If you're the type of person who kind of, you know, not very nice, you take things from other people, or you kind of stretch the truth, or you have hurt other beings, then when we sit down, these things come back to haunt us. So that's why it's always good to, even when you're outside of, you know, practice, to keep the five precepts at a minimum, to not have the intention of, you know, harming any beings, harming anybody else, and also not taking what doesn't belong to you. Be as pure in our speech as possible, and be as kind as possible. So this is where having a soft mind, having a kind and gentle mind helps the meditation. Because when you're sitting down, you can rely on your own goodness to brighten the mind. You're not, you know, all these kind of misdeeds, acts that we might have hurt other people or hurt ourselves, doesn't come up to haunt us. So the way, the antidote to restlessness and remorse, when you sit down and close your eyes, is to, you know, to try as best as we can to live a good life, a harmless life to yourself as well as to the people around you. So that's the antidote to restlessness and remorse. And the fifth is doubt. Doubt is sitting here and you're thinking, should I watch the body? Should I sweep the body like a guenka? Do vipassana? Or should I do samatha? Do the breathing? Or should I count my breath? Should I note? You know, all these different things arises in the mind. And which one is natural? Doubt, unless you are enlightened, you have some doubt. It's the part of the condition of an unenlightened mind. One of the way to kind of calm that down is to do some reading or get in contact with some teachers about what the Buddha actually taught. Okay, to know something about the Dhamma, to study the Dhamma, that way it can satisfy, you know, certain type of doubts, and also to ask questions of teachers about aspects of the Dhamma that you don't understand, how to practice. But the only way you can truly go beyond doubt is to start having your own personal experience of what peace is like, what stillness is like. So as your meditation deepens, then doubt naturally falls away. You know, if you experience a peace of meditation, then you know for sure that is, you know, it's something that is achievable by everybody, something that you're capable of. So you don't doubt the teaching, and you certainly don't doubt yourself. You know that you can, you know, get there. For a lot of us, there's lots of self-doubt. You know, it's easy for Ajahn Brahm to do it. He was born with jhanas. He was born, you know, in full lotus. But I don't have such great spiritual qualities. You know, I can sit and sit, and I've been doing this for 20 years. Not one moment of peace. I'm never going to get there. And that come up from time to time where we compare ourselves to other people. But ultimately, the more we sit and what little peace that we can build up, then it gives us an inkling of what we can achieve through our own efforts. And then doubts will naturally fall away. Right? You know for sure, you know yourself, you know, that you've tasted what peace is like. And then you don't have to argue with other people. They say it's possible, not possible. It doesn't faze you. You know that it's achievable. So that's the five hindrances, five obstacles to peace and the stillness in your meditation. Right? Sensual desires, the antidote to that is happiness in the mind already. Cultivate, you know, any kind of happiness in your mind, in everyday life. Be kind, be gentle to the body. That way you're not stressing it out unnecessarily. Second is ill will. And antidote to ill will is loving kindness, friendliness, unconditional acceptance. Sloth and torpor. So number three is to make peace or to go to sleep. Okay. Then walking meditation helps occasionally. Or you can also open your eyes. I think the Buddha recommended a few different strategy. You can rub your limb, but I guess a bit noisy when you're sitting in the sala. You can do that. You can walk backward. That'll help you stay awake a little bit. So there's a few different techniques that you can try, but I find that by far the most a successful one is just to make peace. And it's a good test to see how much you realize non-self when you're nodding backwards and forwards and everybody's looking at you. And also that's the reason why it's not a problem to nod as long as you don't fall over. Okay, so that's number three. Number four is restlessness and remorse, which is the antidote to that, is to live a good life. To check your moral conduct, the five precepts specifically, and not to break them. Okay? Fifth is doubt. And the antidote to that is to do some studying of what the Buddha said, the suttas, the discourses in the books, to ask questions of different teachers you come across, or to have an experience of peace, what that feels like. Then you won't have any more doubts. Okay? So that's the five obstacles to meditations. Any questions or comments? Yes, so the question is, wanting to experience metta, is that sensual desires? Because you want something that is not already there. Yeah. But at least it's, wanting something positive at least. But there is some craving to it. Okay. Any questions or comments? Yes? Yeah, good question. You have to ask the Pali scholar for that one. You remember Santuti? No. like I said, because it's of a certain kind. It's not the restless thinking. It's the restlessness that comes from the fact that you haven't kept your sila, your precepts, or your moral conduct. Yeah. So it's that, the restlessness that comes from that. From being afraid that you might get found out, being afraid that people might do what you just did to them, being the kind of thing that you see, like is portrayed in the movies or whatever, where you see that the bad guys or whatever, they seem to get away with things, they rob banks or whatever, and they get away, but they're always drinking, and they're always moving around. So that sort of restlessness, that kind of fear that comes from not doing. Hurting other people or doing, breaking laws, it gives you that restlessness. So it's not just the restless thinking; it's more of a specific kind of movement, being afraid that you might be found out, being afraid that you might get caught. That's the restlessness, as far as I know. Yeah. Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Yes, Chiwei. No. The question is that it said that Ajahn Brahm is born in four lotuses. No, I said he was born in full lotus. In full lotuses. I don't think so. It's meant, like he must have been meditating on his way out. Highly unlikely, but I don't know. We can ask Ajahn Brahm on next retreat. Okay, we go to the questions. Dear Ajahn, during metta meditation, when thinking about someone whom I love and cherish, is it okay to think of my pet or someone who passed away? I find that I have to focus quite intently on the positive talk, focusing on the person's happy, fair, and the feeling of warmth in my heart. I find it difficult to do all this at one time and feel my fear getting very tense, my face getting very tense, especially around the eyes. Can you suggest any tips, please? Or is it what am I doing, or is what I'm doing okay? Thank you. Okay, let me take the first question. During meditation, when thinking about someone whom I love and cherish, is it okay to think of my pet or someone who's passed away? I think you certainly can think of your pet. Any living beings is good to... But you can direct your metta towards. Someone who passed away, for some reason, is recommended that not to do metta towards someone who's passed away during metta meditation for some reason. I can't remember what the reason is, what the Thai master says. But for some reason, it's generally recommended. Does anybody remember? Tuti? Sandeep? No? Okay. Okay, so yeah, Santuti thinks that if you send metta to a loved one who passed away, it might, make an attachment for them, and then if they're attached to it, then they won't go on to another rebirth, so they just hang around. So generally, we would want to encourage your loved ones, if they have passed away, that if you send metta, it just says, I'm fine, and may you go on to another rebirth. Because a lot of our loved ones, obviously through attachment, still hangs around us. To a certain extent, after they passed away. This is traditional Buddhist beliefs for, a month, 2 months or something. So every time we go to do funeral chanting, we do this chanting that, all conditions, come and they cease. So now is the time to you to move on. Yeah. That's just to help them, just to kind of let go of their attachments and just to move on to another rebirth. I find that I have to focus quite intently on the positive talk, focusing on the person's happy, my face, and the feeling of warmth in my heart. Yes, it was just a different suggestion. You can focus one at a time, or if it's helpful, focus on one thing. Just the feeling and the warmth in your heart as well, if that is the clearest, you can focus on that. But ever so often, if you visualize the object of your metta in your eyes, and then just go to the heart. If the heart is really, really strong, stay with that, just to kind of develop that warmth in your heart. Watch it, you kind of expand to the rest of your body, or if it's the brightness in the mind, so watch that to expand as well. Okay? And you're feeling your face is getting very tense, especially around the eyes. Then it means that maybe you're trying a bit too hard. So it's kind of relax, and just kind of relax your face first. And that's my kind of advice for any type of meditation, even when you're watching the breath. Every so often, checking the body, making sure everything's relaxed and comfortable, that we're not putting too much effort into taking hold of the breath, or kind of grinding our teeth as you focus. Just, stillness is a subtle thing. You have to be aware, but also gentle. It's not this hard, willful, tight or tense grasping onto the object. It's just, kind of a gentle hold, and it stays there automatically. When you get really peaceful and still, you don't have to do anything. The more you let go, the more still it is, the more clear the breath is. It doesn't go anywhere. And that's kind of a mistake a lot of people make. They think they have to, really grab hold of the breath for it to stay. But the more you let go, the breath stays automatically, effortlessly. And that's how you know that your meditation is finally progressing. When the breath is just there, minutes after minutes, without you having to do anything. And it's very clear, and it's very, very gentle. And the key word is effortless, right? You're not holding it. Yes?
For me, the letting go is very subtle.
Right.
I can tell how my energy is shifting.
Right, yes. The comment is, the letting go is very, very subtle. It's not something we can force. It's something that just happens. And she was saying that you can feel by just the energy in your body becoming more and more subtle. Okay, any other questions or comments? Does that make sense? Which sutta? Which talks about? The bardo, or the bardo state. I think I've come across before. I think the Tibetans are much more detailed regarding this bardo state, which means, I believe, the state where you go to after you passed away. In the Theravada, we just believe that you take a rebirth, and going to the ghost realm is a kind of rebirth. And usually because of our attachment to our loved ones or our house, people stay around the house, your car, whatever you like when you are still a person, you tend to hang about. Because, you know, there is the body and there's the mind. So the body might, you know, get worn out and be kind of, you know, expired. But your mind is still around, right? You haven't become enlightened yet. So the mind, because without the body, usually hangs around where it is closest to. Usually your family, your kids, your loved ones, yeah, your pet, whatever. Yeah. So that's kind of our more of a traditional Buddhist beliefs. Okay. Yes? I think they're roughly the same, but I think it's, I am not sure because I don't know exactly what the bardo state is. I just know that's a state, from my understanding, is referred to happen when you, just after you passed away from the human birth, human life.
It's a 3 months period.
3 months period, yeah. Okay. I think in tradition in Theravada, I think it's 49 days. And that's why they have monks over to chant, you know, the first 49 days, basically reminding the dead person that to rejoice in all the great merit, the good merit that they made in their, during their life, and to understand that they have passed away, and to go on to another destination, and not to hang about. Yeah. And also to allow their family, and this is a good time, to make merits for them. When you've passed away already, and you're in this time, you cannot make any more good karma. You're relying on your relatives. So when your relatives, traditional Buddhists, is that they make offerings, they do the acts of generosity somehow, and they said, you know, whatever goodness I generate through, you know, giving blood, helping charity, doing, you know, helping monasteries, I dedicate this goodness to you. And because they're around, they can hear and sense that and brightens their mind and they go to a better destination. It's like an upgrade in their ticket, Ajahn Ram says. I'm driving business class now. Yes? Yes. Yes, let me repeat the questions for the tape. The question is, the chanting is for, you know, after you passed away. Is there anything for to do for a person where they're approaching death or when they're dying? Yes, pretty much the same thing. You also have monks who come to your, you know, people's homes or hospital, and to also encourage them to reflect on any act of generosity that they may have done, practice, and also to prepare them for that the moment when it does, you know, when the body finally breaks down, to try as best as they can to let go, to become peaceful, because the last few minutes, from what I understand, can be quite painful. The body is shutting down. Usually, you know, the body is fighting for its breath. You know, your lungs are flooded with liquid or whatever. It can be quite painful, and that just not to allow the pain to push the mind into a dark state of ill will, of anger, and also to make sure that you direct the mind towards all the good acts that you've done, and not to go into guilt and remorse at all the things that you shouldn't have done, because that will also push the mind to a darker state, a rebirth. So usually we try, you know, to bring up a sense of accomplishment, anything they've done that is good and wholesome. We remind them of that. In the case regarding dementia or any of those sickness when people aren't so aware, we have a few Pali chanting, just wishing them well-being, you know, and yeah. But it's not anything specific regarding dementia. Yeah, just generally regarding sickness and having, you know, kind of old age in the body. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions or comments? Yes, Jiwei. That's the thing. Also, dementia is more of a function of the brain kind of degenerating. But the mind sometimes can be very clear. Yeah, so they, you know, anything to remind them of that, just to keep awareness, to be still, can also help. Yeah. And also, that moment when you are passing away, it actually can be very joyous because you're letting go of the body, which is full of pain anyway. You're sick with cancer, old age or something. When the body shuts down, it could be quite an ecstatic feeling. That's why people see bright light and your happiness. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Moving on. Venerable Kemawaro, I like my new mantra, not me, not mine. It's better than my other one, not my business. Can you refresh us on the other morning's wisdom you have given us, please? Well, this morning was not me, not mine. Like I said, to be relating to anything around us, you know, the contact, the feelings in your body, what happens in terms of noise, people around you. And the one before that was just to be mindful of your four posture when you're walking around throughout the day. When you're sitting, know you're sitting. When you're walking, know you're walking. When you're lying down, know you're lying down. You're sitting at the table, just know that. Just to be. Like I said, meditation is trying to shift awareness from thinking, 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 down to the body. Just to feel what's like. Just that much. It doesn't have to be very complicated. You don't have to recite, you know, the whole suttas, Tripitaka that the Buddha wrote. You just have to know, am I sitting? And what does that feel like? Yeah. Okay. And the one before that was nothing to do, nowhere to go. Just an encouragement, just, you know, calm down. You don't have to meditate 10 hours a day. You just have to be here. Meditation's around just being here. A sense of not having to do anything. You have no responsibility, no agendas, no expectations. Being in the present moment. Yeah. So those are things that we can always, you know, work with throughout the day. Whether we're sitting in meditation or just walking around doing our business. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Dear Venerable Sirs, after your account on Monday night about why you became monks, I've discovered that each of you are funny, sensitive, and something, a pedigree of male specimen who makes you guys a very eligible bachelors. Uh-oh. I don't know about this. I don't know where this is going. Do women ever ask you out on dates? What if you do if a 20-something drop-dead gorgeous bombshell has the hots for you? What would each one of you do? Well, Santuti, you can answer it first. Very naughty.
If you don't own up, I won't answer the question.
We make sure we don't include her in the next future. We'll take the Fifth Amendment on that one. Now, the first funny incident was the monk was when I was in Sydney. That was the first. I actually had a marriage proposal. I was like, but it was a young girl, and she didn't know much about Buddhism, so I just kind of gently explained to her that monks do not get married generally. I think general people who come to monastery know the certain kind of, you know, degree of restraint, and that the monks are kind of, and the nuns as well, they're trying to go on a different path than the worldly desires of having, you know, family and jobs and so forth and relationships. That it is hopefully through meditation that most of us are staying in the monk, because we have, you know, found a peace that is deeper and more fulfilling than the usual happiness of the world. It could be of achievements, of relationships, of having kids. Yeah. And I know Ajahn Brahm, you know, kind of says quite often that happiness of meditation exceeds that of the other, of the five sense world. But I think it's not entirely correct. It's different. I think obviously he wants to encourage people, so he says, you know, meditation is better than that. But it's the peace that comes from meditation or living the monastic life is the the happiness of emptiness, the happiness of stillness. So if you're looking for excitement in the five sense world, then you're not going to be able to find the happiness of peace. And so it's better not because it's more exciting, right? It's not. It's better because it's not there. It's better because it doesn't excite you. That's why it's better. Which is hard to, for most people to understand. It's like, huh, what? You like, you know, not having to get stirred up. Most people like the feeling of sexual attraction being stirred up. But once you're a meditator, you see anything, anybody that attracts you, you actually find it's quite uncomfortable. It's this heatiness that heats up. It's like, no, I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in peace. So you stir your mind away from it. And we have lots of tools to stir our mind away from that. You usually look at the old people in the hall. Look at the old ladies. They walk around. They get lots of attention from monks. And if it's a very attractive lady, you look at her least attractive parts. She'd be a zit in her face. Whatever, different things. Look at that. That way it kind of balances out the mind. Because the mind with lust is always looking for the attractive parts. So we try, you know, to train against that, to go for the unattractive parts of a person. You also, you know, we do lots of body contemplation. You think, you know, you cut this lady open, is her intestine very attractive? Is her, you know, liver very attractive? What does her lungs look like when you cut her up? Probably not very attractive. Peel the skin away. You know, what does that look like? Just muscles, right? Muscles and veins. And there's also Ajahn Thun, very, very soft monk. He says, yeah, you see attractive lady, just cut her head up and put her into the closet. Wait a few days and open it up and see what it looks like. Not very attractive. So anything to kind of break this delusion that this kind of attraction is permanent, the beauty that lasts forever. No, beauty is literally skin deep. You take the skin off, it's not very beautiful. Right? So those are the different kind of tools that we have to combat something that's, yeah, natural enough for the untrained mind, which is lust, right? Sexual attraction. Yeah. But hopefully, as monks and nuns, we're going in the opposite direction. Right? And that's why, you know, we treat everybody the same, you know, as a meditator, as a being, man, woman, whatever. You're not looking to kind of impress people, not looking for a date, just looking just to help. Everybody's just a meditator here. Not young, not old. And as we meditate, you can see that this body of ours is very superficial. You know, a man, a woman, Asian, Westerner, educated, not educated, young, old. That's very superficial. Once you meditate, become still, the mind goes through all that. And if you hold on to any of your kind of attributes, physical attributes, it's actually a deterrent for deep meditation. Because deep inside of each and every one of us, we're just a mind. And that's the thing that will go to stillness. You attach to the body, then you're always feeling every single sensation in your body. You attach to your health. When you get sick, you get very worried. Right? So hopefully the monks and nuns are good examples of that there is happiness beyond, you know, the worldly happiness of, you know, the body. Yeah. Any other questions or comments?
It's not only a problem for monks, it's also a problem for the lady boy.
Yes.
Because once you are married, for example, like you.
Right, that's right. With the comments, so obviously it's not just a problem for monks and nuns. It's also a problem for lay people, especially in people who are in committed relationships. You do have to find means to be content with that one person. Questions or comments? Clarification? And the 20-year-old something drop-dead gorgeous blonde? She's not very drop-dead in 60 years' time, right? We also look at her mother. What she looks like. Okay, dear Ajahn, to create the best condition for insight to arise or for investigation in outside of the jhanas, is it the level of stillness that is attained, the length of time spent in good meditation? For example, half an hour of level 5 or 2 hours at level 3. 5 being deeper than 3, obviously. Thanks. Yes, it's. I mean, in the books it says you have to, you know, hit the first jhanas and then you can start to investigate. But I think most teachers would tell you that any level of peace is good enough to develop, to start to work on the insight practice of looking at, you know, things as impermanent, looking at things as suffering and not self. And the more you contemplate that, your contemplation can also bring the mind more peace and you can go deeper, actually. So it's something that you can always do, no matter where you are in your samatha, stillness practice. Any peace you have, especially at the end of the meditation, just bring up the three characteristics. You know, is this, you know, what is impermanence, what is happiness or suffering, and what is non-self. And then once you realize any of these kind of truths, one it sinks deeper, because when you have a peaceful meditation, the mind is more open, and it can accept and reflect deeper of these realities. Then once you accept that, it might even go deeper. So these things kind of, you know, roll around each other and they help each other. So it's not practicing one or the other. These complement each other. And it's something, you know, to do. And not to worry about whether you have a really good meditation, you do more contemplation. No, it's something you do on a regular basis. That way, you know, it's both the stillness and wisdom and insight practice are just, you know, both tools that you can use anytime. During your meditation, you know, during your practice, you know, to gain deeper stillness and also to gain deeper insight. Venerable Kemawaro, it is interesting to hear about what Buddha Dhamma. I would like to hear more. Where is your nearest town? Is that where most of your support is? Which national park are you in? Is there a book about the history of this monastery? How many people live there? Thank you. I'll say just a few words about what Buddha Dhamma. It's been around for 30 years, so it's one of the older monasteries in Australia, actually. And it was founded by Ayakema, who is a very famous lay teacher. She founded a nunnery in Sri Lanka, and also she founded Buddha House, also a meditation center in Germany. She donated a piece of land while she's a layperson, eased the letterman, and then became a nun. The nearest town to the Wat is Wiseman's Ferry, and it's next to the river. It's quite pretty, very picturesque, but it's more of a weekend town. Normally you get, I think, about a few hundred people, and on weekends it doubles because people go there to enjoy the river. And no, our supports do not come from Wiseman's Ferry at all, because with any kind of country town, quite conservative, mostly Christians, I run an introduction meditation course there, so we had about half a dozen people, 10 people show up, interested, but, you know, still not so familiar with, you know, kind of Buddhist monasteries. So we do have like open days a few times a year to let people know about it. But they still have a sense that it's a monastery and you really can't go to it unless you're invited. But most traditional Buddhists would know that it's a monastery, it opens every day and you can come anytime you want. But the local people usually have to, you know, they wait until they're invited officially on open days and they come. Yeah. So we don't receive any support, actually, from the local town, except one. They have a couple of family. There's one local guy, Rob. He's been very helpful. He's a Buddhist. And he comes about once a week just to help with the maintenance work and stuff like that. So we do get some support from the local town that way. And the national park that we're located in is called Darug National Park. It belongs to the Darug people. And we're actually surrounded by national park. To the right of us, it's about 12 kilometers. But north of us, you can walk for 70 kilometers. And still, you know, be in the national park. So that's one of the kind of unique aspect of the monastery, is that it's surrounded by national park. So there's no electricity and there's no running water. We rely on solar power and rainwater. So it keeps life very simple. Yeah. And I'm not sure there's a book about it, but Prakantipalo is quite famous. So before he disrobed, a very well-known teacher, he taught in many places. He taught at the Buddhist Society as well in the early days, led a lot of retreats. But now he's older, and he is not doing so much. And also as a layperson, he's not doing so much teaching, because there's a lot of monks and nuns in many traditions teaching now. Yeah. And how many people live there? Right now we have Pasadika from Bodhinyana Monastery, and also Amanda's. So those are the two long-term residents. And we have other people who come for about a month or a couple of weeks doing their own retreats there. So it's still a small community, and there's lots of accommodations because it was built as a retreat center. They changed it to a retreat center a few years ago. Yeah, but before that, the way he set up, because the monastery was so early on, and because it was so far away, he set up more of a monastery, a hermitage, and a village. So there are kids, Australian kids, who were born at the Wat, and it made any sense. They weren't keeping the 8 precepts, that's for sure. But there is 11. Yes. And then, yes, during the retreat days, we've all sorts of interesting stuff happened in the sala. There was belly dancing. We bumped it from the 5 precepts to the 8 precepts as soon as the monks got there. So no more belly dancing in the sala. And now it's just the traditional forest monastery with everybody following the 8 precepts. And there's morning, evening chantings, trying to do it kind of a traditional Thai forest monastery. Yeah. Yeah. Questions or comments? Yes?
Who cooks for you?
Right now, Amanda's. But whoever is staying there, because as you know, in our tradition, now it's kind of the clincher. We always have to have a lay person in the kitchen to help prepare the food. So on the weekends, because it's far, people come on the weekends to offer the requisites, the food, and then hopefully during the weekdays, somebody is able to stay there and to cook. Yeah. So far we've been lucky. Someone usually shows up. Yeah, a man is from Bodhinyana. Yeah. He's spending the rains there. And then we'll see what happens afterward. Yeah. Okay, this is advice on chanting. I would like to encourage people to read Ajahn Sujata's words on page 38 of the chanting book. Let's all join our voices and be heard with metta. So that means somebody wants you guys to chant louder. Okay, so we'll see what happens tomorrow. Oh, this must be for Venerable Buddharakita, I think. How did you become a novice in Burma? What was your experience like? Can you tell us about your practice? Was it difficult to get Burmese government approval? I think as far as I know, I was ordained in Thailand. Venerable here was ordained just across the street. So it was, I think, Venerable Buddharakita who ordained a couple of times. Yeah, we'll wait if wants to come tomorrow, he can answer that. Okay, dear Ajahn, I'm trying to be mindful in every moment. I'm trying to know every step I take, every breath I feel. But at the same time, I feel very stressed. I feel tense in my head. I have bad dreams, and it doesn't feel natural. Should I persist or should I just relax? Yes. Mindfulness. And tomorrow I'll talk about the 5 spiritual qualities, which are, what is it again? It's very important. It's faith, saddha faith, and then you have, once you have faith, you have energy. Once you have energy, you have mindfulness. When you have mindfulness, you have stillness. Once you have stillness, you have wisdom. It's about causes and conditions. Mindfulness is the same thing. You have to establish the causes for mindfulness to arise. It's not something you force. And trying too hard will give you stress. So that's the thing. The cause of mindfulness is actually energy, and that comes from happiness in the mind. So, yes, my advice would be to relax, back off a little, to do things that make your mind happier, do things to satisfy yourself. Have an extra cup of tea, that's allowable. Sleep longer, take a nice long shower, take a nice walk. Not too long shower, sorry, I have to say water. Yes, wear warm clothes, anything to kind of allow the body to be slightly a bit more comfortable, not to be too tough on yourself. Yeah, and then mindfulness happens. So just to know that, it's not something you can force. Forcing, you will become aware, but you also become aware of suffering. That's what you become aware of mostly when you force yourself. Yes, the comment was that it was just like feeding your sensual desires. But there's the balance, because you know, unless your fairly has a certain amount of happiness, the mind is going to crave for that anyway. Yeah. So a little sensual desire, it's not the end of the world. I know sometimes we say, oh, no, I shouldn't like this or whatever. No, enjoy your food. It's good. Good food, good healthy food. Enjoy your tea. That's also allowable. Yeah, as long as you don't disturb other people. We're talking, a conversation. You know, make the most of what's allowable under these circumstances. Because the mind has to have a certain amount of happiness. If we're trying to kind of power our way through, we'll get stressed. And, you know, there's kind of a symptom. It's called samadhi headache. Right? It means you're trying too hard. So we have to be careful. When you're getting tightness around your face, your chest, or your shoulders, then said, okay, I'm trying too hard. I should go take a break, go lie down, you know, take a walk in the forest, anything, just get kind of relaxed. And said, okay, maybe I won't meditate so much. Yeah. And that's why we did what we did this morning, kind of move things around, get people kind of, you know, a bit loose. Because it's fun, right? Meditation is fun. You have to understand that. You have to get that number one principle. It's not something you kind of force your way into. You grit your teeth. And then one day, one glorious day when things happen. No. Sorry. You have to be happy. And it's a fun path. It's fun being on it, and it's fun at the destination. It's not something that you grit until, you know, it's not like other religion where you have to kind of pain, suffer, and then you die and then you go to heaven. No, Buddhism is great. You know, the Dhamma is beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, and beautiful in the end. So, it's, you know, it's a joyful path until you become enlightened. And that's what's great about it. You don't have to worry about how many times you have to come back, because each time you come back, you're happier and happier and happier. The same with different stages of enlightenment. The people who are, you know, on the stages of enlightenment, they become happier and happier individual as the mind realizes letting go. Okay? So we establish the conditions for mindfulness. We establish the conditions for stillness. We don't make it happen. If anything, we don't make anything. And it happens. Right? So it's more accurate to say it happens. And you are just there for the ride. Okay? Yes, Chang? Right, yes. So the comments is true. Just try to be playful with your meditation object. Eat your dessert first. Or, you know, and yeah, do anything silly without disturbing other people. And yeah, that is allowable. Yeah, so just kind of, you know, like I said, yeah, just experiment. Just sit in different places in the forest, meditate, standing, whatever, to bring this freshness in the mind. A happy mind is a concentrated mind. Remember that. A happy mind is a concentrated mind. An unhappy mind, a miserable mind, it won't bring you to stillness. You know, no pain, no gain. It doesn't work in meditation. Okay. Thank you for your teaching and your smile. So that's just a fan mail. Okay, so that is the last questions. Any other final questions or comments? Good. We will continue sitting. or we can call it a night.